The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
I am Sardou, master of the theater of the macabre. Tonight, we begin with torture. Again, I warn you that if you find what you see is a little upsetting to your stomachs, then just pretend we're play acting. For if you are skeptical or bored, then just pretend that what you see is real.
To another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is WDET reporter Rob St. Mary.
Thank you, sir. So kind to be here in the projection booth of the macabre with you, Mr. Mike White. But can you do me a favor and not run with those scissors? Somebody might get hurt.
This week we're looking at a classic, Joel M. Reed's Bloodsucking Freaks. Originally released under the title The Incredible Torture Show, Bloodsucking Freaks tells the story of an off-Broadway theater run by Sardou, master of the macabre, and his henchman Ralphus. The pair puts on an act of torture and depravity, all in the name of art. Behind the scenes, things aren't quite so wholesome. Released in 1976, Bloodsucking Freaks is a film made in the Herschel Gordon Lewis gore tradition. There's fake blood, eyeballs, and body parts aplenty. It also mixes a myriad of fetishes like fornophilia, impact play, water sports, and more. And in some respects, it's a precursor to today's torture porn films. Rob, before we dive right into the movie, you've got a good story about how you came across the film. I want you to give us a scoop.
Back in 1997, here in the Detroit area, I made a little vampire film called Tainted. And that was back in the pre-digital days, so we shot it for about 30 grand or so on 16mm. And in 1998, in the final days of VHS, if you remember those, if you're old enough to remember when dinosaurs roamed the earth, Troma Entertainment in New York decided that, hey, you know, my little vampire film that we made here in Detroit would be just perfect for them. So they picked it up. And we went to New York to sign the papers for the distribution deal. The folks over at Troma Team Video, which is the video wing of Troma Entertainment, best known, obviously, for The Toxic Avenger, Class of Nukem High, things like that. We're talking about, you get to raid the prize closet here. Nice. At Troma Team Video. So it's like, whatever movies you want on DVD or on VHS. So, and this was in the early days of DVD. I didn't have a player yet. So I took a whole mess of VHS tapes back to Detroit with me. You know, some of the bigger titles, as I said. And there was all this discussion around Bloodsucking Freaks. And how it was just, it was one of those notorious titles in their library of films. And I'm like, yeah, I'd heard about it, but I'd never seen it. So I was like, yeah, okay, well, you know, put that in the bag and I'll take that with me. And then on the plane ride home from New York, I had received an autographed copy of Lloyd Kaufman's book, his autobiography that he put out in the late 90s called All I Need to Know About Filmmaking I Learned from the Toxic Avenger. And in there, he talks about the early days of Troma and picking up Bloodsucking Freaks, and he talks about now, and even on the front of the DVD that they put out, that if Joel M. Reed came to him now with, which was then The Incredible Torture Show, and then Troma relabeled Bloodsucking Freaks, he might not put it out. He just said that, you know, this movie has no socially redeeming value, this movie is just, you know, horrible, it's, you know, anti-woman, and it's misogynistic, and it's just, I don't want to...
Because Lloyd Kaufman's always the purveyor of fine taste.
He is the purveyor of fine taste. I mean, you know, so it was just interesting that he wouldn't want to pick it up. So, in matter of fact, it's kind of a hobby of mine to actually collect kind of banned or notorious things, be it books, film, you know. I think that you learn more about the people who want to ban and censor things based on what they don't like more than the actual art itself. Because It's like over time, if you go back and you look at certain things, it's like, really, it wasn't that bad, you know, some of this stuff. And I always think what people get upset about really tells you quite a bit about them. So the first time I watched it, I gotta admit, I couldn't get Bloodsucking Freaks out of my head. So I watched it again, and then I even wrote an essay like in the late 90s. I think it was like 99 or 2000, which I remember the title was, it was called Sucking Meaning from Bloodsucking Freaks. I can't find it now, but I basically kind of postulated this theory that Bloodsucking Freaks, with all of its nudity and gratuitous violence against women, is actually a pro-feminist statement.
I went back and, of course, rewatched Bloodsucking Freaks this week. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, I can't believe that I used to watch this in high school all the time, apparently. Well, it was one of many films that we would watch. But it was, I mean, with that box cover art just calling out to us at Blockbuster. And of course, you know, again, Blockbuster, they're out there censoring and pulling basically classics to me, like Suspiria and these kind of films. Bloodsucking Freaks, no problem with that movie. Not at all. No. Absolutely fine.
Last Temptation of Christ was notorious. They pulled that.
Bloodsucking Freaks, no problem whatsoever. But yeah, that was great to see. And it was nice to revisit. You know, I think what appealed to us was the gratuitous violence, the gratuitous nudity, but really the humor that's in the film and the relationship between Sardou and Ralphus.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we talked about, you talked about in the introduction that Bloodsucking Freaks really is maybe the genesis for what we see as torture porn, or what some people call gorno, you know, the gore porn, you know, the Saw films, the Hostel stuff, things like that. But I think that Bloodsucking Freaks has more humor.
Oh, yeah.
It's definitely lighter. It's fun at times. Hostel's not.
Well, they leave no stone unturned. I mean, there isn't a moment in Bloodsucking Freaks where there's any kind of normalcy whatsoever. I mean, the scene that comes to mind is Ralphus cooking up dinner, and it can't just be dinner. He's got a whole frying pan full of eyeballs, you know? It's like everything has to be twisted in this film, and that's kind of what I enjoy about it.
It's one of those films for me, it's like I can't watch it all the time. I mean, I watch it every now and then. I mean, like every couple of years, I might pull it out or something like that. And to be honest, I don't think I've ever watched it with anyone that I've dated.
It's not really a good date movie.
No, it's, I mean, I have like test films, like Raising Arizona is a test film.
Oh, yeah. That's
like, I'll tell you that if you want to start dating a girl and you show her Raising Arizona and she hates it, run the other way because, yeah. But the thing is with this one, it's like, I've been kind of afraid even to show, like, my ex-wife.
Right.
You know, when we were together this, because I was afraid she might run the other way. But if you look at it on a superficial level, if you look at Bloodsucking Freaks on the superficial level, yeah, it's horrible, it's anti-woman, it's all this stuff. But if you look at it on a deeper level, and you look at maybe sort of an art level or a symbolic level, there's a lot more going on there.
Well, even at a surface level, I mean, it's just so outrageous. Sardou is trying to put on this show, and it reminds me a lot of, like, Wizard of Gore, where, you know, you don't know if these tricks are real or if they're not. And, of course, all the tricks are real. All this stuff that he's showing to the audience is 100% real. He is killing people on stage and doing these horrible things, cutting off body parts and you know, screwing these massive headgear into this woman's head and all this kind of stuff. But it's just so silly at the same time, and you've got all of the fake blood effects and just, you know, how ridiculous it is. Sardou is there and he's trying to put on his shows, and he's doing this all in the name of art, really, you know. It's just like he wants to put this on, and he's getting kicks from it, obviously, and he's got this whole cavalcade of women down in the basement, all in this cage, who I don't know if they're necessarily participants in the show at some point, or if they're just going to hang out there the whole time, because they're like...
They guard his money.
They guard his money.
The money under them. That's because they're crazed women.
That's right. And then you've got Ralphus, his henchman, who's played by dwarf Louis de Jesus. The main thrust of the plot is Sardou trying to get this ballerina to dance for him. At the same time, he's got a critic who's really kind of capping on his show.
Mr. Silo, a donation for the actors.
Actors? No true actor would submit to engage in such trash.
But you are going to review my show.
Absolutely not. You heard me in there. If I were to review your so-called show, even badly, I fear some of my readers might come just out of curiosity. And I do not want to be responsible for keeping your theater open one more day.
So Sardu is just incensed. He wants to have people watch the show. He wants to spread his entertainment around, and he comes up with this brilliant idea of this sadistic ballet. I don't know about you, but I'd be first in line for tickets for that one.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, like, the ballerina is supposed to be, she's supposed to be like one of the finest ballerinas the world. And she's supposed to be at Lincoln Center, which this to me is funny because, like, everything looks like, in terms of design, it looks like it was all shot in the same space.
Oh, yeah.
And it has, like, if anyone has ever been in theater or done theater, it looks like it was all shot in a black box theater. Mm-hmm. So there's no windows. All the walls are black. The bedroom's that way. The police, you know, office is that way. Sardu's hangout is that way. You know, it's like, wow, I didn't know that Lincoln Center was so grungy.
Yeah.
And the thing you were talking about with the critic is that Joel M. Reed names the critic Creasy Silo. Mm-hmm. Now, for us nowadays, we might not remember back in the 70s and in the 60s, there was a great critic for the New York Times named Clive Barnes. Mm-hmm. Silo, Barnes, get it? And he also does theater and dance, which is exactly what Clive Barnes always used to review for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole thing in there. So there's this whole idea that Reed's asking in terms of, like, what's the place of the critic? What is the place of the critic? And I think in a lot of ways, maybe he's writing Sardu's dialogue as his retort back to critics who maybe had torn apart his earlier work, or maybe even he knew were going to tear apart this work. Because, I mean, Reed had a few kind of minor hits in terms of exploitation film. Probably his most well-known one from title alone is Career Bed in the late 60s. So it's kind of interesting how he uses that. And it's really kind of interesting also this interplay. Like I said, if we take it on the level, which we'll get into a little while later, is that maybe Silo also represents maybe the new wave of thinking in terms of sort of the place of art, or the, if Sardu represents sort of the patriarchy, then maybe Silo is sort of like the evolved thought of the modern man, in a way, the more educated man, as opposed to this. You know, I'm not to say Sardu isn't educated. He obviously, he is. He has sort of a continental accent. I've kind of put him as sort of like a low-rent Hannibal Lecter, or maybe even sort of a less flamboyant Joker character. Mm-hmm. You know, he has that kind of sadistic attitude and humor and, you know, proper manners and things like that attitude.
Right, because at no point do you hate Sardu, which is interesting to me, because he's doing all these horrible things to people, but he's so much fun to watch while he's doing it.
It's like, it is like, in a way, like Hannibal Lecter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a guy that we root for, but against maybe another part of us that we wouldn't want to.
Right.
The other thing that's interesting, too, is that if you notice in the film, he never personally tortures anyone.
Right.
So this gets into the whole dynamic with Ralphus, in a way, Louis de Jesus' character, who is, he's a dwarf. Not only that, but he's also a person of color. And the only other people who are Sardu's assistants
are also
two black women.
Mm-hmm.
And they do all the torturing. So there's this whole kind of like, is Reed trying to make a statement about, I'm the white man in charge and I send these minions out to do my bidding? Like, one could even say that, and it might be a stretch, but one could even say that maybe that was sort of the cynicism of the time because of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And there was so many black, a disproportionate soldiers, amount of black soldiers that went to the front to do the bidding of the patriarchy, I guess, if you reconsider it at the time, of the white man with the power. And Ralphus talks in that step and fetch it kind of master this, master that.
Mm-hmm.
And
right, you've got the two different levels of master. You've got, well, actually three. You've got the Igor kind of master, you've got the S&M type master, and then you've got the slavery master as well.
Yeah, and I would even go one further, because there's a point where Sardu's like hurt at one point, and he's like, Ralphus is tending to him, and there's this whole kind of dynamic, which I remember, I used to read a lot of Malcolm X stuff and hear a lot of speeches and things like that. And Malcolm X would talk about the difference between the house and the field slave.
Right.
And the house slave would always be like, oh, we sick? Mm-hmm. You know, we hurt master? You know, right. It's like he would identify with the man in the house, while the field slave was the one that wanted to kill the master.
Right.
So there was this, you know, dichotomy on the plantation. But the thing is that within the world that Reed's created in Bloodsucking Freaks, the Ralphus character is very much sort of, I guess, as Malcolm X would say, sort of the house slave. And even though he knows he's lesser than Sardu the Master. He still derives a certain amount of power, ability to do things, ability to get off what he needs to get off, either in, you know, in a physical sense, you know, he's taken care of. He gets to, you know, torture people from time to time because Sardu gives him the okay to do it. So there's all these dynamics in terms of, is he making a statement on race? Is he making a statement on, well, on the place of feminism at the time to some extent as well?
There's that very telling scene when Sardu is asking Ralphus to go out and kidnap Creasy Silo. And he's like, well, what are you going to do for me, master? I love this part when Sardu takes his keys off of his belt and moves them from one side to another to be like, you know, I'm moving from master to slave role now. And then it becomes this whole, like, S&M scene that goes on from there.
You've been a very bad boy today.
Have I really been that bad? Must I be punished?
You know, when we were talking about Sardu to some extent, too, is that His character, I mean, Seamus O'Brien as Sardu is really the standout. Mm-hmm. He is the glue that holds this thing together. If he wasn't as good as he is in this film would not work. It would be about another almost 10 years before we would see a similar villain character that we could have fun with, who would joke with us, who would say, hey, I love being evil and I want to make you watch it. And that's Freddy Krueger. I see Sardu as almost that kind of same archetype, especially when we get into the later films. I mean, it's there in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, but it's definitely there by the time you get to the end of the run.
Oh, yeah. This film is such a product of New York. You know, it is. Yeah. You've got the New York accents, of course, and everything, but it's just such a made by grindhouse filmmakers ready for the grind. You know, it's like they as soon as the film was done being processed, they must have sent it right over to 42nd Street, you know?
They actually shot it right next door to the theater where they show
up. Exactly.
Yeah, it totally is. It has that feel, and that's what's so great about it. And there was a lot of things going on in the 70s in New York that I don't think a lot of people really remember now.
Right.
I mean, the first thing is that you have Tucci, who is the cop who Mr. Maverick calls.
Yeah, Maverick, the football player, boyfriend of the ballerina. I like how it's like they don't even need names. They just might as well have been called ballerina, football player, cop.
They're just symbols.
Right.
They really are. Like if that's kind of what I say about this film is that really all of these are just symbols.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, at one point when Ralphus dances, he plays with symbols. So I don't know. Maybe Joel M. Reed was making sure you got the point that these are symbols.
Not only does he get to play with symbols, but then you get that whole awesome background music going on at the same time, which stops and starts exactly when Ralphus starts his symbols. I love that scene.
Crazy synthesizer music. In New York at the time when this was made in like 75, you know, there was a lot of things going on. And going back to Tucci the cop, he's a corrupt cop and he wants a payoff from Maverick and then eventually he tries to get a payoff from Sardu as well. The film Serpico. Now, we look at that film now, you know, maybe if you don't know New York history, there was a lot of corruption in New York police in the early 1970s. And that basis of that whole film is on a guy who blew the whistle on the corruption in New York. So you had that going on. Also, remember, this is like 2 years after Watergate.
Right.
So hatred of the government is still, I mean, people really not big on government. The police can be seen as an extension of government.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still kind of that questioning of authority that's still in there. This is not the Disney New York time. As you were saying, this was the grindhouse 42nd Street. This is the real porn saturated Times Square. This is hell on earth, you know, New York. Right around the time that this film was being made also was New York was in a place kind of like where we're at right now in Detroit, where it looks like the city was going to go bankrupt.
Right.
And the mayor went to President Ford and said, look, give me a bailout. Mm-hmm. You know, this was long before the Wall Street bailout. This is long before the GM and Big Three auto bailout. And Ford told no. And there was all of this sort of stuff going on. There was all this grit. And it's like, I mean, probably for most people who look at New York in the 70s, the one film that kind of echoes, and I think it kind of echoes in this as well. You see it. I mean, I see it in terms of the way the film looks, but also in terms of that grit is Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
To me, Taxi Driver is mid-70s New York, hell on earth New York. This is not Disney New York. This is when Hell's Kitchen was Hell's Kitchen for a reason.
Exactly.
You know, before they decided to change the name. name.
Right. No pretty Tribeca going on here, no.
Yeah.
The world that Travis Bickle was living in, people really think that that's more of the fantasy inside of Robert De Niro's head, and that they don't remember how awful that it really was.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of getting back to, as I said, we wanted to talk about sort of blood-sucking freaks as a possible pro-feminist statement. Mm-hmm. Remember that at the time, this was during Equal Rights Amendment fight, where you had Betty Ford, the president's wife, saying, we need to have an Equal Rights Amendment. Women need to be equal in this country. And there was a big fight to try and get that into the Constitution. Never happened. But there was a lot of, you know, you had at the same time, which I think is kind of an offshoot of that, you had the gay rights movement coming in.
Right.
So you had these underclasses that were coming out of the civil rights movement of the 60s that were starting to make themselves known. And not to say that women weren't underclass at the time, but the thing was is that they were starting to make their way into the workplace. They were starting to make their way into society. They were starting to advocate for, you know, why shouldn't I get the same pay as the other guy?
Right. And you can see Sardu as being a complete reaction to that entire thing, you know, just being to a comical end. Like, yeah. Not only am I going to keep women down, but I'm going to literally keep them down in my basement. I'm going to, you know, torture them and whip them and use them as table furniture and use them as dartboards and just all of this literal objectification of women.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the things, like talking about the wild women in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the wild women in the basement, think about it, caged, naked women,
right.
Caged, raw passion.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing is that he's putting these women in the cage, he's keeping them riled up, but not letting them free,
because
he knows they're dangerous, as he soon finds out in the end. And at the same time, he like pays them off with things. Like the one obvious payoff is in the film, he calls in the doctor to help with the ballerina,
right.
Natasha Denatalie. And, you know, as part of his payment, the doctor gets to torture one of the women, but he goes too far.
Right.
In some, much like, as I said, Hannibal Lecter, you know, he has his limits. You know, it's like there's a certain way of doing things and you cross the line. And so he has Ralphus feed the doctor to the caged women. Women,
right.
Which, okay, let's look at that. Just look at that as symbolism. Okay, you have caged, passionate women, and you have a doctor. What does the doctor represent? Doctor represents status. Doctor represents professional men. The doctor represents maybe suburban life, or all of these things that the patriarchy, Sardu, gives to women to placate them,
right.
To keep them from busting out of the cage. So there's all of this things like that. And then if you look at the tortures, even in the first few minutes and throughout the entire film, they're all based on things that would be ways of controlling passion or ways of controlling them in some way. Like there's the thing with the head, you know, there's the brain thing. There's the thing with the brain surgery thing, as we talked about with the doctor.
Which gives us the new title of Bloodsucking Freaks.
Yeah. Yes. And there's the whole thing with the one dancer that he has, and he cuts off her feet. So it's like, I'm the patriarchy, I'm going to remove your passion. I'm going to remove your ways as a woman to express yourself, to be passionate, to all these things. There's one torture where he shocks the woman through her nipples, you know, with electronic shocks. And you could see that as maybe an assault on sex in a woman, passion in a woman, or even motherhood to some extent. So there's all of these things in there. And then in the end of the film, you don't want to give it away, but the whole thing is that the caged women, as I said, you know, get their revenge.
Mm-hmm.
The women get their revenge in the end. And the ultimate statement of that revenge is the final shot. I'm not going to ruin it for you because I want you to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But the final shot, to me, put it in when I saw Bloodsucking Freaks, I go, this is a pro-feminist statement. That final shot, you know, there's nothing more of an attack that you could do on a man than that. So,
I think you might have just spoiled it, but whatever.
I didn't spoil it completely.
Right.
But, you know, the thing is that the film sets up this dynamic that women throughout the film, when they're used in particular ways, have value.
Mm-hmm.
They have value when they're used in these ways, and they're controlled in these ways. He runs a white slave trade where he brings in women. The first scene you see in the film is two guys delivering a crate to Sardu and Ralphus. And it's like, what's in the crate? Well, they open the crate and it's a woman, you know, and he's selling them to other people. The whole thing is that you can see that this whole control of women, and it's like the value in Sardu's world, which you could see as the value that the patriarchy puts on women in the mid 70s. If you want to look at it on that symbolic level, is that you are of value if you do what we want you to do, if we can control your passions, or if we can sell you in some way, if you become a commodity.
Exactly.
And then there's the whole thing with the S&M, where he's he loves doing the S&M, having people do the S&M for him, because, as I said, he doesn't torture anyone.
Right.
You know, the only thing he comes close to in torturing someone is the dart game,
mm-hmm.
or and the backgammon game.
Right.
You know?
Which is a great scene.
but there's also this whole thing where it's like, he has the thing with the woman who's a dinner table,
mm-hmm.
where he's eating dinner off the woman's back, and she's complaining, and he's like, don't you spoil my dinner.
Right.
And all this. So there's this whole thing about women as domestic objects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like your proper place is a domestic object. You
right.
know, that's what we see you as. And going back to the thing with Ralphus and then the two black women,
mm-hmm.
you can almost make a case that with Sardou, they represent the 50s nuclear family, and that one of the women could be the silent mother who mm-hmm. never stands up
right.
to the horrors that her husband is doing. The other could play the sister, and then Ralphus, of course, is the little brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the son who's being taught by the patriarchal father,
right.
you know, to go Here's out and follow what I do, you
right.
know, I'm going to show you my son at my knee how mm-hmm. to control
right.
and how to do these things.
Yeah, it's very telling, too, that no matter who was going to play that role, it was going to be a dwarf. So having Ralphus be of color and small in stature was just so telling as far as keeping this person at a level that he wanted to see Ralphus be at, basically.
He didn't have to psychologically do it.
Right.
He just had to literally stand next to him.
Exactly. Yeah, he was always going to be at his knee because that's as tall as he reached. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe his waist.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's just, like I said, I think the film is so much more rich than people give it credit for.
Mm-hmm.
I think that those who see it as this notorious movie that has no socially redeeming value, is just misogynistic and anti-woman and horrible, I think they're only watching, like, I would say just the plain first level, just the visual. But the thing is, it's like, even with that, maybe in 1976 it was disturbing, but compared to Hostel, it's not. It's almost like Hostel is like Bloodsucking Freaks on steroids. But Bloodsucking Freaks is like Mr. Rogers nowadays compared to some of the real torture porn stuff that comes out. And to be honest, I'm not a fan of that stuff.
Right.
I'm not a big fan of the torture genre stuff. I mean, and what's kind of funny, I mean, to say, oh, well, did Eli Roth get his ideas from this movie? I'd say yeah, because he did the commentary on the DVD.
He's obviously a fan.
Yeah. And Joel Reed even talks about that, said that, yeah, he would like follow me around. He was trying to make some documentary on me. So, I mean, obviously, Bloodsucking Freaks did play a role in that whole genre of film, whether you like it or not. It's the genesis point. It's where it starts.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, speaking of the interview that we did with Joel M. Reed, let's go ahead and we're going to play that interview back. It's, I think it's pretty darn fun.
How did you get into film and then writing and directing?
Well, I was in the Army, actually. I could have gotten out 3 months earlier, and I applied for different schools. And I met my friend on the subway, and he said, would you like to go out with a couple of actresses tonight? I'm going to their apartment. Actually, we went out on a date, and I said, I think I'll become an actor. So I signed up the American Academy, which gave me a letter immediately for early discharge from the Army. I don't know if I was really intent on getting in films, but I acted and I got into advertising. I got into commercials. And one day in the 60s, I decided to make a film. And that was with Joe Sarno. I met him and I wrote a script for him called Career Bed. And he said, all we need is $10,000. Go out and get it and make the movie, you know. So I, in my being very naive, went out and got $10,000. And when I called Joe Sarno to come over and direct it, he said, I'm going to Sweden, you direct it. And I said, I haven't the slightest idea how to direct a movie. And he said, well, basically, I do not either. So that's how I got introduced to movie directing. And how Bloodsucking Freaks came about, I had done several movies and I was trying to raise money for them. And this agent, Dorothy Palmer, called me up and said, would you like to see an off-Broadway S&M show, ballet? And I went down to Green Street and I saw Niles Fontaine and his nude girls do sort of S&M dancing. It impressed me. And a group of potential investors that weren't putting up money for my little horror film asked to see Niles' theater piece. When I brought him down, they said, if you make a movie about an off-Broadway theater, you know, with S&M, we'll back it. And I immediately wrote the script that night with a lot of contributions from these potential investors, adding things from their deep desires. And when I finished it, they didn't give me a nickel. And then at the end of the year, this lawyer, Joel Weinberg, called me up and said, can you make a movie right away before January 1st? And I said, yes. And I told him about the script. He said, I don't care about the script. Just make the movie. And I went over to his office and picked up $125,000. So that's how that movie came into being. I mean, in my life, I was in very well mixed up with Broadway and movie society, but I started to make movies just by accident.
Now, Bloodsucking Freaks wasn't the original title. What was the original title? Because I've heard there were several different ones.
Okay, it was called The Incredible Torture Show. Stanley Borden at American Films thought we had a major picture. I was just looking from the ad in the paper. I just discovered it. He bought 100 prints and opened it across the country as a major film. He spent a fortune on it. And we opened at the Cinerama Theater on Broadway. Of course, the film didn't catch on, and I thought it would be better as a midnight show. And Stanley, after the bad opening and not too good reviews, decided to not do anything with it. Years later, somebody introduced me to Troma. They gave me some money up front, and they didn't do very much, but they put it on 42nd Street. And Bill Landis saw it and wrote this rave review in the East Village Other. And that brought it to life again. And we went into the 8th Street Cinema. And the film caught on to a big audience. We were playing midnight shows. And I think among the celebrities was Michael Pollard. And people like Andy Kaufman were coming to almost every performance. In fact, Andy Kaufman brought his wife one night. And she was yelling at him, you stupid motherfucker. Or this is what you do on the weekend, seeing the sick shit. So that's how it began. And then Woman of Pornography got into it and started to pick at us. The film built up a reputation as a midnight show thing. And I think Troma made a lot of money off of it without doing very much.
The story you talked about, you know, you were developing it because these folks had seen this sort of S&M ballet that was sort of off Broadway. As for sort of like the themes or different things that you were trying to write in there, I mean, obviously the Creasy Silo character, who's a theater critic and a dance critic for the paper in town, he's obviously a reference to Clyde Barnes.
Of course, Creasy Silo is actually, if you take translated into English, Creasy was the big battle where Clive won in India. And Silo, of course, is French for Bond, so it's very obvious, you know.
Were you trying to make a satire of sort of like off-Broadway or...
Yes, I was making a satire. I have no interest in S&M. I thought it was very funny, you know. That was the whole idea. It shocked a lot of people, but I was just going, you know, even the William Morris joke, you know, and things like that. It was totally a satire. My humor is very sick. I don't believe in beating up people or young ladies, you know. Now the humor applies. People realize it. But when it opened, I don't think anybody caught the humor. You know, very few people. I only did it. I should have made it on another script. But there was a check for $125,000 awaiting me. So I went and shot the movie.
Can you sort of share some of the stories on how you met the cast and some of the key people? I mean, kind of starting with Sardou.
Well, actually, I was a signatory to SAG. And I was doing the movie under SAG regulation. And I think John Suki, the president, called me up and he said, we're making this a student film. I said, why? He said, well, we didn't read it, you know. And he said, we don't want to make this an official SAG film account of the content. So you can do it anything you want. But SAG says this is a student film, so we give it, you know, full grace and pleasure to go ahead and shoot it and not pay anybody. But we did pay SAG rates. Most of the agents sent us people in New York, and Seamus O'Brien came from an agent. And he was at that time playing the uncle in The Fantastics and had a long list of credits of Broadway and movies, and he was perfect for the role. Louis D'Aizu was, we had Hervé, the dwarf from Paradise Island, and he was hanging around the office, and he was our first choice. And when we were ready to shoot the movie, he was in France, so we called him in France, and he said, it's hard for little people to get laid in New York, so I went to see my girlfriend in France. So I said, come back. And he said, well, you have to pay half the ticket because you didn't call me. And about exactly that moment, Louis D'Aeser walked into the office and we said, what's the difference between one demented dwarf and another? And we hired Louis, you know, but we had at least 800 people come up to open calls on this thing. You know, I was telling the girls, please keep your clothes on. We haven't got the time.
How did you hook up with Hervé? How did you know him?
Oh, Hervé just came by one of the calls. We had enlisted a Screen Actors Guild, and he was one of the, probably the only little person that came to our call. I don't think anybody else came. When with the first group of investors, I started casting with it, and they never put up any money. And that's when I think I met Hervé, and he all guaranteed the money, and I never saw a nickel. You know, that was like 2 months before we actually got into production. You know, Hervé didn't have any reputation at the time. So he chose Louis. His son's been calling me, or a little guy that proclaims to be his son. I haven't met with him yet. He looks a lot like Louis.
Speaking of Louis D'Aeser, I mean, he went on to a career. Now, was he working in hardcore before?
No, I overread it. Louis, I don't think had been in any movie, and this was his first movie. And he went on with Bijou into Jerry Damiano and to make a picture called Let My People Come. And he went on to do that. And then he became known as the Anal Dwarf. You know, I saw him occasionally after that. He died of a heart attack not too long after. He died at a very young age. Bijou went on to a short career in porn, and then she got involved in drugs and spent time in jail in Mexico and up here. And then the FBI was looking for her, and I had a hide out to keep her from coming over to the apartment because I didn't want to deal with her anymore.
I heard that Seamus O'Brien also ended up meeting sort of a tragic end not soon after the film was completed.
Yes, she was murdered right after the movie was done, and there were several stories. I was at his wake. Somebody said that he caught a burglar in his apartment. Somebody else said that it was a black guy sitting on the stoop in the East Village, and he asked him to move, and the black guy stabbed him. And somebody else said he picked up a black guy and brought him home, which I don't know. You know, Seamus had a bunch of children and stuff. In essence, he was stabbed to death one night in his apartment or on the front door, front steps of his apartment. He was a very wonderful guy. I mean, he and Louis were working together and working out the scenes, and Seamus was helping Louis so much, you know. Seamus had a long, long list of credits of an actor.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask is, you know, what was sort of the day-to-day like on the set? Sort of take me through it. How long was the shoot, and when did you guys shoot? Kind of thing like that.
Well, we shot many hours. I think we shot 10 days, but we shot, like, without sleeping. And it was a very wonderful, everybody was happy with each other. We had plenty of food, and it was a lot of fun. You know, everybody was great except Bijou, who never learned the lines correctly and always had somebody picking her up. We wanted to leave after an hour, but we had no problems. We had one girl in the cage who walked off her set. She was walking around totally naked, but her boyfriend was interfering with everything, and I told her to get him out of there, so they both left. Outside of that, there were no problems at all. You know, everybody was wonderful. In fact, one of the girls in the movie, my friend applied for a job, I don't know, at Reader's Digest International in Boston, and he walked into the vice president's office, and he saw a poster of Bloodsucking Freaks on the wall, and he asked the girl interviewing him why she had the poster, and she said she was in the movie, and she was proud of it. She's one of the girls, backgammon girls, I think. And somebody said one of the girls in the cage went on to stardom. I'm not sure who. I still hear from some of the people in the movie. Got to realize you're senior citizens now.
There's a lot of rumors related to the film, and there was one that I wanted to kind of check by you and see if this was, you know, bullshit or not. And one was that Louis D'Aeser had orchestrated an orgy on the set on the last day.
No, there was a party up at a script girl's place. It was very rich. He had a duplex apartment. And downstairs, it was rather conservative. Upstairs in the bedroom, there was actually an orgy going on. Everybody was doing coke. And I guess it's okay to say that they're both dead. And Bijou came in with a guy, she said it was Rod Stewart, but I think he was a phony. And they were getting married. And we had a drink. And she said, what's going upstairs? I said, everybody's doing coke and getting drunk. She said, I want to go. I said, no, it's pretty wild up here. I walked her upstairs and everybody said, take your clothes off, Bijou, you can't stay. And she did. She turned her clothes off. She started giving me head. And then I looked down, she disappeared. And there she was in the middle of the floor being f***ed by Louie, who had a quite a big dick for a sizer. And that's a, quite a wild party upstairs. I promised to f*** one of the girls on the movie. And I, like 9 o'clock the next morning, I was half dead and I had to disappoint her, you know, but that was a really great party, you know, for those times. I mean, Vija was far from being a virgin, but then they went on to make porn together. I saw her with about 8 guys on top of her, you know. But she was a real weirdo. I try to avoid having any close relationships with her, but I was so stoned at the party, you know.
The actual look of Bloodsucking Freaks is pretty gritty, and the colors are kind of muted. And it came out around like the same time as Taxi Driver, you know, that sort of same era in New York. And I was wondering if that was your idea to make it look kind of like that, or if you just, it was just kind of the film that was around at the time that it made it look kind of muted and really kind of gritty.
I think because Troma is too cheap to get a new print, but the original prints were very good. Ron Dorfman, who I don't know what happened to it, shot it, you know, and it looked very good. It was shot in 16 millimeter and blown up to 35. It was actually too Hollywoodish. It's grainy now. It's accounted the thing they're releasing, you know, because I have a brand new print of it and it looks gorgeous. We try to make it look as best as possible. We shot with an Aeroflex 16 and then we blew it up to 35 millimeter.
You talked about the original release of the film. It didn't really go over the first time and then it kind of came back under a different title. Talk about what the audience was like. I mean, how did they react when this movie first came out?
Some of the people walked out. I think they... It was playing in major large theaters, and it was completely wrong, you know? We intended to be a midnight show in the beginning. I had seen guys walk out. But when it started playing midnight, you know, people picked up on it. You know, once in a while, you get the odd girl that would walk out on it. And as the years passed by, people got more and more of the humor. I don't know where Women Against Pornography, I think Troma called them up. We would have played forever at the HB Playhouse. I know it played 56 weeks by Harvard. I think it was a film before its time. Somebody's just looking at it, you know. It wouldn't shake up anybody. It was the little guy that did Hostel, you know, and Eli Roth. He was hanging around here for years. He was one of my fans. I think he follows my school, you know, but his films are much more disgusting than mine, graphically. I intended the whole thing as a joke. Now I look back at it, and I should have started a serious artistic venture, which would give me a reputation as an auteur. But now I'm gaining that reputation.
When Michael Herz and Lloyd Kaufman of Troma picked up Bloodsucking Freaks, they were just kind of starting out. Do you remember sort of your interactions with them?
Yes, I was very friendly with them. Nobody wanted to film. They gave me money up front. We made a deal with Vestron Video, which I got half of, was a big check. And I never heard from them again. And then my partner sold them the rights to the film without, basically, he shouldn't have. Now they call me up every once in a while to do a, you know, a director's thing, and I won't do it. You know, they offered me $500. They supposedly paid Eli Roth $35 to put the DVD together, you know, and I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in getting on and working on some new projects. But right now, they don't talk to me. I don't know what their situation is, and I'm very happy not to talk to them.
One of the things that was something that Lloyd, I think, told me when I talked to him before, and I wanted to see if this was another myth related to Bloodsucking Freaks or not, was that he said that he possibly had hired, I think he told me he had hired protesters to protest the film to, like, gin up controversy.
He called the people from Women Against Pornography, and the problem was that is the landlord of the A Street Theater, they had a clause of no pornography in their lease. So they tried to evict the guy that ran the theater. So he had to stop the film playing there. I don't think they hired him. I think they just called up.
Because he made it sound like he had hired people to protest it, and then the real protesters showed up. Not that he had called the pornography people.
The real protesters did show up, and they stopped playing the film at the HB. So I think he contributed to that. That story is true, yes.
One of the things that's interesting about it, and And I mean, I understand the times in that way that, I mean, this came out in the middle of like women's lib and all of that stuff. I remember when I first saw Bloodsucking Freaks the first time, I saw it as the satire, as we talked about, but I also saw it as you were putting, and I think you were putting things in the film, and this is something I wanted to ask you about, from my estimation, is actually kind of pro-feminist, because in the end, the people who are oppressing the women pay in the end.
A lot of women have seen the film and asked me to make a sequel, which the women dominate the men, you know, totally. I wrote a script, actually, when I first wrote this, which is Bloodsucking Freaks Part 2, where the villain is a 14-year-old girl who gets her kicks out of beating up on men. It's very funny. It's much more humorous. You know, it's just something done in a hurry, you know, if you would afterthought, you know, but I thought it was funny. I enjoyed doing it. People enjoyed working on it. And women like it much better now. Back in those days, the women found it very messy, you know, whatever, it was a woman-hating film. But I just do those things to make money. I did it because there was money there, you know.
It's been like 35 years since it first came out, and I was just wondering, you know, how maybe your thoughts have changed on Bloodsucking Freaks over that time. You look back on it today, are your thoughts different on the movie?
Oh, if I went back on it, no, I don't think I would make it less apologetic. There's not much you can do to it. When I think about it, I think I should have put more humor into it. It's really, no, I think that's what it is, you know? I think that it's been surpassed in violence and cruelty. I have projects, but not with that much S&M in it.
Speaking of things that are a little more sadistic, and you kind of talked about it a little bit, like Hostel and Saw and the so-called, you know, torture porn genre, you know, that seems to have happened over the last 10 years or so. I mean, to me, I look at those and they kind of seem like ginned up versions of Bloodsucking Freaks, but I think Bloodsucking Freaks really has more humor. It's lighter in tone.
I'm basically a humorist and I have a lot of followers. People send me films that they made or they're going to make and they're very vicious. You see all of Eli Roth stuff. I'm sure you did. And he was a fan of mine. He was hanging around in the apartment. I don't know where he got the muscles from. He was shooting a documentary about me and following me on the subway. And his stuff to me is very vicious. You know, mine was humorous. That's the difference. If I would do something again, it would be very funny because I'm really into, not into S&M per se. I don't, man, ran into people. I mean, I've had girls come up who have seen the movie, you know, the movie, and they expect me to beat them up and stuff, which I don't do. I mean, a couple of girls in the movie were real masochistic. When they read the script, they would come over and say, tie me up, you know, a lot of trouble. I said, can't we just f*** or something like that? And they said, no.
What's sort of the worst thing that's happened to you out of this movie? I mean, has there been good things, bad things? What do you see out of Bloodsucking Freaks for yourself?
I don't think anything bad happened out of it. A lot of good things. I've been invited to a lot of film festivals, and I met a lot of fans. You know, I down at the Cinema Village and for Halloween night, and everybody's asking for my autograph. I can't think anything negative of it. Now that anybody saw the movie and said, get out of my life. No, that hasn't happened. On my first movie career, but people are still writing me. I made that for $10,000 and I got very esoteric French critics writing about it now. I'm not ashamed of anything. I should have been more like Brian De Palma and did something way more on a higher pretentious tone, you know, but that's what I did. The situation was right.
What have you been working on recently? I know you were a writer. You wrote some sort of like pseudonym books from time to time, but what have you been doing?
I published as a writer. I've sold some screenplays. I did about 7 movies. I'm putting together a cute little thing about teenage girls. I don't know if you saw the latest. I don't know if you're familiar with the French or the schoolgirl type mild pornography. Like they send girls to schools. Of course, they're bad and they spank them. But the whole idea is that they can't graduate. They have to be virgins, you know. So they get enemas and stuff like that. I have a cute little thing like that. And that's the only one that's wild out. I have a couple of zombie movies. One is actually a takeoff on low-budget film companies like Troma, where they don't feed the actors or pay them. And this company, Jersey City Productions, goes on location to down south to Kaplan Swamp to shoot their highest budget production ever and run into the real zombies. And the joke is that the filmmakers are more menacing and apprehensible than the zombies themselves. And actually, in the end, the zombies finished the picture, and they're so sick and perverted, they end up becoming big shots in Hollywood. Hollywood is being run by zombies now, and it's a very funny takeoff on very low-budget pictures where nobody gets paid or fed or anything like that. But, of course, the budget, you can't do anything for $125,000 right now. If you guys want to write out a check, we're ready to go.
I was going to ask you about, you know, you do these screenings, you meet people who are fans of the film. Are you amazed that, you know, 35 years on or so, people are still interested? And what do you think is maybe the common thing that ties together people who like this movie?
I don't know. I think obviously humor. I had a thing this winter at this theater in Brooklyn. Actually, the only people who came was from a Jewish religious school. All these kids that had to come with their parents. Oh, well, a lot of my fans are 11 years old. They're goths, you know. And here is all these kids that couldn't go by themselves. I think the oldest was 14, and they're fans of the film. I guess in the spring, I got a call from Sag Harbor, New York, and this girl sounded very interesting. And I'm very careful because I have a lot of young fans, but, you know, and she sounded much like an adult, so I arranged to meet her at the cafe, pick me up on Avenue Way in the village, you know, and when I walked in, I saw her. I knew who she was right away, and I said, I hope your mother's with her. She was 11 years old. Her mother was there.
Do you advise that 11 and 12-year-olds should watch Bloodsucking Freaks?
That's right, yes. One of my fans came over, and she was just starting high school. She had half her head shaved off, you know, just hair on one side. She was 12, I think. She had a tat. She had piercings and a lip And I said, well, are you in high school yet? She said, no, I started in the fall. I said, you got to straighten out your act. She said, no, I'm going just like I look now. The other students. So those are my fans. That's the bulk of my fans. I have a lot of people that know every line in the picture. Incidentally, Dan Fossey, the cop in the movie, went on to be the head of 20th Century Fox, you know, and he had a memo out. If anybody mentions that movie, I'll fire them. And actually, his daughter was supposed to get together with her. She's producing movies out on the coast, and she said, I'm going to talk to my father. But I never heard from her again. So I hope to do another movie, you know, if they're not too old, you know.
Where should folks go if they want to keep up with you, if they want to see what projects you're working on and your past work?
I have a joelemreid.net website, and then I'm on Facebook. I have one parting thought. I did a show out in Los Angeles at the Palace Theater, and I was signing autographs, and this couple came with this little kid. They were holding him by the hand, you know, and they said, can we take a picture with you? And I said, sure, and I got over and put my arms around. They said, with my son. I said, what do you want a picture with my son, your son, for? She said, we don't like your movie. He has to watch it every night before he goes to bed. I said, how old is he? She said, 2.5. So there are a lot sicker people in the world than me, or maybe I'll grow up to be a priest or a rabbi or something. Who knows? Thank you, God.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
So that was a very fun time talking to Mr. Reed. He definitely has his stories down. A few weeks ago, Rob sent me a couple of YouTube clips of Joel introducing the film, talking about the film. And it's funny, his stories are pretty much identical to those clips.
And he made almost the exact same mistakes.
Exactly.
Instead of saying Fantasy Island, it was Paradise Island. And yeah. Let My People Come, as opposed to the Jerry Damiano film, the guy who did Deep Throat,
right.
Let My Puppets Come. I don't know. I mean, Let My People Come almost sounds like if it was Moses.
Right.
You know, sort of like freeing the Israelites in Egypt in a very sexy way.
Right. As I mentioned before, I said that no matter who was going to play Ralphus, it was going to be a person of smaller stature. I can't imagine what this film would have been like had Hervé Villechaize played Ralphus.
It just would have been amazing. I think that, you know, Hervé, I mean, everyone knows him now,
right.
You know, obviously. I mean, he's gone, he's passed on, but he was such an iconic person when he was around. I mean, he captivated people in a way, you know, that I think really no small stature person had since maybe The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Or Billy Barty.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Billy Barty, probably the most popular dwarf. I believe that the guy who is in the Pirates of the Caribbean movie might be kind of catching up on Billy Barty's territory. I'm having a hard time picturing him as Ralphus because Louis de Jesus captures that role so perfectly. He is so awesome in that. I mean, he just the dancing around and just being so happy all the time.
Yeah, I almost think that Hervé would have been a little dark.
Yeah.
I think he would have been a little more sinister.
Right, right.
Well, Ralphus is sort of like a jester.
Yeah,
you know, he's
definitely
like this kind of clown. He's just laughing his head off throughout mm-hmm. this entire thing. He's just having fun. It's just amazing to watch him. I mean, they just kind of wound him up and let him go. It's crazy. I haven't had a chance to track down the Damiano film, Let My Puppets Come, because I haven't seen him in that. But I have to say, the Anal Dwarf? Man, what a title.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was before Bloodsucking Freaks, I guess. It was a loop. It was only like, I don't know, 10 minutes in Super 8 or something. But it was a notorious loop, I guess. And that's where Joel Reed said he first met him. He knew the film. So I guess right. if you hung
I've
around.
I've seen your work before. Very impressive.
Brilliant.
Even though he didn't have it, I picked sure Joel M. Reed with a big cigar in his hand all the time.
That was great.
But some of the people who are in it, the one who plays the ballerina, Natasha de Natalie, Viju Krim. Oh,
wow.
Joel Reed talks about her in the interview and just how, like, kind of...
Not you know? A rocket surgeon.
No.
Yeah, that her performance is just amazing. I had forgotten how bad it was. And really, throughout most of the movie, I'm just like, okay, you know, I'm watching this, I'm just like, whatever, she's not that good and stuff, but it's not painful until you get to a run of dialogue.
I'm sorry I didn't call you, Tom, but I've just been so tied up with my new show.
Well, you're here willingly?
Oh, of course. I mean, Lincoln Center, it is just so boring. You know, one Giselle after the other, that would be the only thing that I would have to look forward to. Believe me, Sardou is a genius. This is where it's all at, right here in Soho.
I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but that's pretty amazing. And then, like Seamus O'Brien.
Oh, yeah.
What a loss. I mean, I think he could have been just an amazing character actor. It would have been nice to see him in other things. I know that Joel M. Reed said he has like a bit part in maybe Marathon Man or something.
Mm-hmm.
Real small, like maybe one, two line kind of stuff. Did a few other things, but he was mostly like...
He should have played the Laurence Olivier role in that. Is it safe?
The dentist, yes. The crazy dentist.
Him and Ralphus making an appearance again.
But that's what's so good is that he is just... I think he nails it.
Oh,
just,
yeah.
No way. I'm like, it's just perfect. It's just perfect,
yep.
You know? And he, like, I don't know if he had that accent, because I think he may have been from Ireland or England or something, but he just has this accent, and he has this, like, presence about him that he, like I said, like, low-rent Hannibal Lecter.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a certain way of doing things. He's proper. He's a gentleman in that way. You know, it's like he's not getting his hands dirty.
Right.
He's going to have everyone else do his bidding for him.
You know that even when he's having dinner on that woman's back, he's probably got the salad fork, dinner fork.
he knows which utensil goes where on that setup on the plate.
He could have dinner with the queen or on the back of a woman slave, yes.
But some of the other people who are in it, I guess the guy who played Tucci.
Mm-hmm.
He went on to be an executive at 20th Century Fox, as Joel M. Reed tells us. And then the guy who played Creasy Silo, I can't remember his name, but he was in, I first saw him in the opening scene of Putney Swope, right. Robert Downey Sr.'s, I think, probably masterpiece film from the late 60s. And that's where I first heard him. And it was more like I heard his voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw Bloodsucking Freaks, I was like, oh, it's the same guy. But I can't remember his name. But he was just, you know, a great... great actor as well. I mean, because if you're going to play in those scenes against Seamus O'Brien as Sardu, you have to bring it.
Right.
Exactly. You know, yeah. And he does this awesome job bringing it. So I've got a lot of respect for that actor. He just does an awesome job. When we talk about Bloodsucking Freaks, I mean, for you, I mean, how does it kind of fit with other films that were maybe out a little bit before or during that time?
Well, it reminded me a lot of Pink Flamingos. The women in the basement reminded me of the women that Mink stole and her husband were keeping and impregnating and then selling the babies, if memory serves. It's been So that, and then even the when the one of Sardu's helpers flashes Creasy Silo and she's got the fake dong hanging from her, reminded me of the flashing scene in Pink Flamingos. So there was that, which had come out just a few years prior to that, I believe.
The one that it reminds me of, and it just came out the year before, mm-hmm. was Ilsa's She-Wolf of the SS.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It really, to me, in terms of tone, the look of the film, things like that, I mean, I think of it kind of like the male companion piece to Ilsa. I mean, obviously, Ilsa was the sadistic camp guard in that Nazi exploitation classic with Diane Thorne, made by the guy who worked with Herschel Gordon Lewis, right. Dave Friedman.
Right, but, which kind of was, I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary on the Stalag books, I believe it was Israeli documentary that came out a few years ago talking about the long history of sexy Nazi prison wardens and mostly in literature, but yeah, mm-hmm. Ilsa definitely came right off of that page. And yeah, just the torture for torture's sake, all these different sadistic tortures kind of reminds me too of some of the women in prison exploitation films, of course, too. You know, my favorites being The Big Birdcage and The Big Dollhouse. Seeing a woman strung up by her hair would not have been out of place in any of these movies that we're talking about.
Yeah. And then, you know, you talk about Waters and you talk about Herschel Gordon Lewis, and it's mm-hmm. what I would call the trash aesthetic.
Right.
And
the showmanship as well.
Yeah.
You know, these filmmakers were showmen as well as filmmakers. Yeah.
So, I mean, it was really this sort of almost kind of, you know, garage band idea where you just kind of get a few friends together and you hack it out. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, as I talked about, it's like the whole thing also is that the actual look of the film, the look of the film itself, it's really desaturated.
Mm-hmm.
Like the effects aren't very good, you know, if you look at it that way. But the thing is, it's like it's almost like the grain of the film mm-hmm. and the way that it looks. It's like the only other film I can kind of think of around this period that kind of looks this bad and puts this sort of sense of doom over everything that really kind of helps to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it was really bright kind of Technicolor, it wouldn't work. Is Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Where if it looked really bright and it was Technicolor and all that stuff,
right?
You'd laugh.
Yeah, no, you totally would. This movie needs to look this rough. You know, Joel had talked about in the interview that he's got this great print of it and the colors are really bright and all this. Yeah, I don't want to see that. The version that I saw, and for folks listening, this is available right now over on Hulu. You can go and watch it, which just, again, seems really strange.
Which it's great when they put, like, ads in the middle for, yeah. like, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, right. and, like, shaving supplies. And
but, yeah, it's so strange.
Back to the torture.
Exactly. But I love that transfer, like, listen to the audio. There's, like, this, like, horrible rattle, like the film is coming off the sprockets, you know?
Yeah. Just, yeah, I heard that. What it is, it's the shot, it's the exterior establishing shot of, mm-hmm. I think, the art museum
mm-hmm.
where they kidnap the art critic, Creasy Silo. And it's got this
right.
kind of like, almost like you use in the Projection Booth podcast here.
Right.
And you asked me about it, you're like, is that projector?
Right.
Is that a camera sound? It's like, what is that? And I was like listening to it and I go, well, it seems to be like a shot that was done silent.
Right.
Because why would you need sound for that maybe? But it almost seems like someone was transferring the sprocket holes
right.
through the optical transfer.
Well, yeah, it reminds me of when you were back in elementary school and they were showing something on 16 millimeter and it would start coming off the rails, you know, and you just get that like horrible noise and the people just start getting all distorted and everything.
But that's part of the charm and the quality.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You know? I mean, if Joel M. Reed has a really bright, colorful version of this film, he should never release it. He just should never
exactly.
do it, because it would destroy that ability, because it's like, I don't want to see like tomato ketchup bright
right.
red blood.
All that. Yeah, I want to see that.
I want
fakey
this
blood.
Dark
yeah.
kind of brownish red colors and like, everything looks drab.
But yeah, even seeing Bloodsucking Freaks on DVD was a little much for me. It was too clear. You know, having seen this only on VHS, I would almost posit to say that you should be seeing this in a multi-generational copy. You know, I think that would help. You know?
Like the most beat up
exactly.
tape you can find.
Exactly.
Get a sixth generation that's been run over by a steamroller.
Exactly. It's like, what if you saw the guinea pig movies, you know, first run, brilliant, you know, DVD, digital transfer, you know, Blu-ray. You don't want to see that. You want to see something that somebody's passed around and has been through the mill and through the comic book convention circuit kind of thing. Something that you ordered out of the back of an old, you know, film, Monsters of Filmland kind of magazine.
You got to get it under the table at
exactly.
the comic convention in a brown paper bag.
Exactly.
With a label that says something else, but you know what
right,
it is.
Right.
Not only did it stick with you, but you put Ralphus on the cover of your book.
Right.
I mean,
well, which is crazy. I think I told you this story before on your show on DET was somehow Jim Rugg, the artist who did that, he based all those characters that were on the cover off of stories that were inside of the book. I don't think I've ever written about Bloodsucking Freaks before, but yet he knew or somehow keyed in to me and put Ralphus right there on the cover. So it's just like the one thing that, you know, is on the cover that isn't in the book, but it's perfect. It just, I think to me, Ralphus kind of represents, you know, what I am all about, you know, because I do enjoy that kind of, you know, cymbal playing. I enjoy wearing the yellow shirts with the brown overalls, you know. Yeah, obviously I wear my hair the same way and everything. So yeah, it's just kind of the way I like to live my life. You know,
when it comes to dinner, the eyes have it.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, no safe, sane, and consensual play for me either. You know, just forget about that.
Throw that out the window.
Exactly.
That's right. Give me a vise and a tree saw, and I'm good.
All right, let's take a break. We're going to play a clip from next week's show, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Now you understand the conditions of your parole.
I got to get along with you, or you're going to send me back to jail.
Dustin Hoffman.
You're on parole?
I figure I served my time. I just earned a little bit of freedom.
My friend, I see that you're going to force me to deal with you.
Straight Tie.
All I want to do is get a job. Job.
Dustin Hoffman.
Well, it's like a dream, you know. It's every con's fantasy to... Yeah, out here. I can't tell you the number of times I thought about a scene just like this.
Straight Time.
You can't trust me. I mean, what the hell? I'm just wasting gas, right?
I don't want you to waste your gas.
Why are you going to kill us, Matt?
Dustin Hoffman. Straight Time. Dustin Hoffman.
You're harboring a fugitive.
Took my chances.
I mean, a cop could knock on that door, put you in jail.
Straight Time. Dustin Hoffman.
Wait a minute. What are you doing?
You step back, please.
Straight Time. It's the time it takes for a man to lose or win.
And And we're back. That was a clip from next week's show all about the film Straight Time. I'll be joined next week by author Andrew Rausch. In the meantime, be sure to check out his crime novel, The Suicide Game, which is a lot of fun to play at home. That is available via Amazon or from some of your finer book retailers. So, Rob, you actually brought over a poster today of Bloodsucking Freaks, but under its original title, The Incredible Torture Show.
The poster is so much more beautiful and artistic and sort of Carney Barker. See this, see that, see this. It's just great.
Yes, yeah, totally, and calling out to the audience, and we should describe it a little bit. It's got Ralphus up at the top, holding an eyeball, and then a woman with her arms raised. Kind of reminds me of Texas Chainsaw Massacre a little bit with that pose, and her body kind of turns into Sardou, and then you've got all the great stuff above it saying "see," and then all the different torches. And I think they kind of use some of that copy on the back of the Troma DVD.
Yeah, some of it. The other thing that they use in there, which is funny, because I always knew that Bloodsucking Freaks wasn't the original title,
right?
Because I'd seen the trailer, and the trailer's hilarious because it's like it's Troma, of course. You know, I love Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Herz. I have a huge amount of respect for what they do, but they're the world's cheapest film studio,
right?
And they're willing to admit that, you know, because at least they're self-actualized, which is good. But the thing is that in the trailer, it's like Sardou, he was the master of, and then it would cut to a completely different voice,
right,
and a title card that goes Bloodsucking Freaks, and it's a completely different tone of voice. So it's like, why would you have two booth guys,
right?
You know, yeah,
re-record the whole darn voiceover, or just use the original.
And to be honest, it's like Bloodsucking Freaks, there's really not a lot of bloodsucking in this movie.
There's the one guy. It's not, you can't even say freaks.
Yeah,
you know, it should be singular.
It's like when I first heard the title Bloodsucking Freaks, what comes to mind?
Vampires.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, and consider this was mid-70s, so Freaks was like, here in Detroit, it was like, you know, the MC5, the White Panthers, right. You know, they're like, fly the freak flag, it was like, woo, you know, it was like, be crazy, be out there, right. So it's like,
freaks,
what is it like?
Out at night.
Yeah, is it like blood-sucking hippies?
Right.
Like, blood-sucking counterculture people?
Right.
So it's like, not really, but the titles are great, because The Incredible Torture Show was, as Joel M. Reed says, that was what the original title was. But Lloyd Kaufman had told me in the late 90s that he was fighting a lot of bootleggers with Bloodsucking Freaks, that people were putting different titles on it. And one of the better titles was The House of Screaming Virgins.
Oh, nice.
That was a good title.
Nice, yes.
The other one was The Heritage of Caligula.
Ah.
And I guess they were trying to cash in the early 80s.
The Guccione Caligula.
Exactly.
Yeah, nice.
And there was a whole series, and you can find these. They're really awful looking, like the box art is just crap. But it's sort of like these, it has like this really bad, like colored marble background, and it has like a coin or something, which makes it look like the Caligula coaster.
Down there,
and then like on half of the coin or something, it'll have like these other things. Like it was sort of like a whole series. I remember like Thomas Video had them, and I never watched them. I mean, the box art was just horrendous. But there was one that was like related to Nazis. There was this one, and it had like Sardou's face on it. And it was called, like I said, The Heritage of Caligula, An Orgy of Sick Minds, is what that title was. Some of the other titles in other countries, one that's good, and I'm not even going to try with the Spanish, even though I had a few years of it in high school, was in Argentina. It was called Sardou, the Theater of Fear.
Mm.
So, and then Sardou, the Master of Screaming Virgins was another title. But I think the House of Screaming Virgins is probably a good title.
Well, although, it reminds me of House of the Psychotic Women,
which was
an amazing film as well. So, I mean, I will, of course, admit that the box cover of Bloodsucking Freaks caught my eye years and years ago, but it's just, it doesn't represent the movie whatsoever. It's got that like weird man bear pig guy in the back with his face all split open and staring down at this table with these women wearing bikinis, which there's no bikinis in Bloodsucking Freaks. Women don't get to wear a lot of clothes in the film, and then this kind of crazed looking guy over to the right toasting a glass and a person's head under buffet server. I mean, that kind of ties in near the end of the film, but the rest of it, So, Rob, I want to talk to you a little bit about your day job. I want to hear what kind of stuff you're up to down on WDET.
Well, you know, I don't usually get a chance to talk about really bizarre cult films.
Oh, yeah.
Where I work. You know, public radio, it's a little bit different. But, you know, I want to thank you for letting me come out and do this. It's great. I work here in Detroit, 101.9 FM, WDET, WDET.org. You can find out more about that. One of the great things since we revamped the website is if you click on any of the stories that I've done, and then we have a list off to the right, and you click on my name, you can get a whole run of everything that I've been doing.
Which I have bookmarked.
Yeah.
So I get to go on there and hear what you've been up to. So.
Yeah, and mostly I do arts and culture, and I do neighborhoods and community. I do a lot of community engagement, so I go into various neighborhoods in the city, various suburban towns, and I meet with folks and try to engage them in mm-hmm. some of the stories and kind of learn more about the area and how everyone can kind of work together. But in terms of the in terms of the arts and culture piece, I mean, like I said, we had you in, and mm-hmm. I had a chance to talk to you about the book. I got a chance recently, and you can find this on the website, to talk to Peter Weller when he was in Detroit.
Right. You got to interview Peter Weller.
Yeah.
I didn't get to interview Peter Weller.
Well, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I should be hanging out with you some more.
There you go. But that's really good. That's up on the website, so you should probably check that out. He was in town because they're building, you know, obviously, if you're a fan of the Projection Booth podcast, you know about the RoboCop statue in Detroit that they're working on. So he was in town for that. He was nice enough to spend some time talking to me about that and just all kinds of stuff with art and various things that he's up to lately. I also do a lot of stuff on the independent film scene in Michigan and in Detroit. Right now, I have a piece I'm pretty excited about. I've done a lot of reporting on Theater Bazaar, mm-hmm. which some folks in listening audience might not know about. But Theater Bazaar was these guys for about 10 years who took over sort of a burned out neighborhood and built sort of this late 1800s to 1930s carnival in a burned out neighborhood in Detroit. And once a year they would hold the world's greatest masquerade.
Oh, nice.
Halloween party. And eventually got shut down by the city of Detroit because they didn't have permits to build a roller coaster and a Ferris wheel a complete midway in their backyard. They're doing a documentary about them. So there's a thing about that documentary and a trailer. It looks incredible.
Oh,
and
great.
I hear some really good talk coming out of that. And there's also a documentary on the Detroit Fire Department called Burn, which looks like it's going to be out next year.
Now, is that the one that Dennis Leary is involved in?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to talk to Dennis Leary, but I did get a chance to talk to the producers and director who have been working on that. One of the producers and directors, she was actually an editor at Orbit magazine here in Detroit in the 90s, and I had interviewed her for my book, which I'm working on right now with Wayne State University Press,
right?
Called Reentry, the Orbit magazine anthology, which covers the history of Detroit's great arts, culture, and humor magazine that was around for about 10 years, 9 or 10 years here in Detroit. And probably the most famous thing in the pop culture for most people was the t-shirt that Mr. Tarantino wears in Pulp Fiction is an Orbit t-shirt.
Yes.
So.
Yes. So. Yeah. If you don't remember that scene, go back and watch. It's when he's playing Jimmy. Orbit was a great magazine. Came out of the Ashes of Fun magazine, if I'm correct.
Yep.
Jerry
Vile, who now does the Dirty Show here in Detroit and in L.A. and in Chicago, and even has sold the franchising to it to some folks in Switzerland and Australia.
Oh, very nice.
So Dirty Show started in Detroit well over a decade ago, and now it's international. Come down and see your erotic art during February.
Yeah, so all the Niagara pictures and all those things. Yeah.
Great.
So yeah, it's a great show, and kind of, if you're a fan of Bloodsucking Freaks, you're definitely going to be a fan of the art that you get to see there as well.
So WDET.org, you can learn more about it. I'm not sure if I still have your interview up there or not. Maybe I might have to add it since we blew up the website recently.
Whoops.
And remade it. But, you know, as always, it's public media, so it doesn't fund itself. So if you're hip and you like it, give us a couple of dollars. I'll say thanks. And while you're at it, maybe give Mike a couple of dollars because he's doing a lot of good work with the podcast here and also with Cashiers to Cinemart and all the books he's working on.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah, I can't remember if I sent you a copy of the latest issue or not.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was really good.
Excellent.
And you were sneaky enough to use me as a quote for your
your
book.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm looking forward to residuals at some point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I'm making money hand over fist from all of my projects.
You might have to go after your publisher, much the way Sardu and Ralphus do.
Yes, exactly. Does that shock you? All right. So be sure to keep up with Rob St. Mary over at WDET. Listen to him live on the air or via the archives. As I said, I've got that bookmark. You should too. Thanks for listening, folks. Be sure to check out more of the episodes of The Projection Booth over at iTunes, via Stitcher, or even on Jackalope Radio. So we're going to head out this week with a rather astounding rap about blood-sucking freaks that I found called Vaudeville Godkill. And I know I'm going to Godkill these names, by Roughneck Jihad and Maestro... It's either Gamin or Gamine. I think Gamite. I'm not sure what it is. But regardless, it is a very fun little song that hopefully folks will enjoy.
Welcome to the show, I'll be your co-host, folks. If I could ask you to lean close, I'll play out the pain like a maestro. Slow, building up the tempo. You see, MCs are weak, so tonight's a real treat. We got trash on the beat, Jahan spit like chains and whips with wit and mystique. Strap you in your seat, this show ain't for the meek. If you run for the billfold, trading your mic for a steel pole. I guess these girls gotta eat, we'll treat you like group freaks, nymphos. First I'm gonna need a new victim out the front row. No, I mean volunteer, commandeer your girl in the big brassiere and flash the veneers. I smell fear and loathing before I rock the mic with a cold sneer. I'm slow encroaching, removing your clothing. Hold back your tears, no moping. Remember, this is your career. Lights, camera, close up with glamour. Scream from the rapture and cheer. It ain't all smoke and mirrors when you're choking. Deep throat squirm like a loach, abandon all hope. Raffless on standby, stroking with a cowboy hat and a rope. Get low till you're broke, your stains leave you soaked. Stank, rank, skeet all up in your flanks till I'm drained. Draw blank, you like finger paint, play it off like a prank. Pain is easy. Sipping my drink, tear streaks look sleazy. Cuts in your lower back, acting real she-she. Smearing the feces, surreal like Fellini. This is the real shit, we sick like Comini. Teasing your bits till they're bleeding. Bust on your knees at these styles, I'm seedy. Ralphie's dancing around freaky.
Aleister Crowley, make them all dance. The haka like a Maori, dope like cocaine, white like a howley. Wild like Europeans down in the Bowery. Flip flipper from mousy to mouthy, the pay is lousy. Regular forms of entertainment don't arouse me. An idea arisen, your beauty has me smitten. Playful like a kitten, warm as new mittens. I offer you the taboos are forbidden. Total submission to the religion of the rhythm. My wise wisdom can guide you on a mission. It's all part of the system, the engine. You pump like the piston, I crank the ignition. Internal combustion, feel the friction. Reddening of ass cheeks when I start. Hidden teeth, monsters in titchin' when your body's bitten. Poking, prodding, parading you, lady. Degrading you, baby. Mistreating you, maybe. You're a volunteer who signed a bunch of waivers before coming here. You know the flavor. Regulars wager on when you will scream. They savor how the sounds come down like a wet dream. Trailer's a savior, he's held high supreme. Latex, polyurethane, and neoprene. Behavior deviant, voyeuristic. Spiritual, lyrical, natural, mystic. Masochistic, sadistic, realistic. Don't blink, now my good man, you'll miss it. Midgets, mammals, chicks, that's obese. Gaming with the white hot flame and iron peace. Looking for some flesh to press underneath. Amateur pimps cling tight to your free.
If you come over, I promise not to whip you.